Thanks for listening to the Art Tactic Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Green. It was great seeing so many of you last week in New York. It was an action-packed week with so many art fairs, gallery openings, and auction previews. The main attraction was Freeze New York, which I think is still really trying to find itself since it moved from Randall's Island a few years ago to The Shed. It's smaller than any of the other Freeze fairs around the world, and most of the New York-based galleries who participate, you could argue, have more exciting gallery shows just a few minutes away in Chelsea compared to their booths at the fair. And now that Freeze has bought the Armory show, which occurs in September, there's a lot of speculation as to how both Freeze New York and the Armory show will evolve over the next few years. So in this week's episode of the podcast, we recap Freeze New York and the entire week. We do so with Naja Sayas, a culture journalist who's the author of several books and is currently writing articles for both The Observer and Forbes. Naja just wrote a thought-provoking piece in The Observer highlighting some of the shortcomings of Freeze New York. So we're excited to chat with her about that and a variety of other topics in the art world. We hope you enjoy the conversation. Thanks so much for listening. Naja, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Adam.
Definitely. Well, I really enjoyed your coverage of the fair, and if our listeners haven't read your article in The Observer yet, I definitely recommend they do. So one aspect of your article that really caught my attention was actually the headline itself, which read, "Freeze brings glitter and gloss to New York, but takes few risks." In what ways were there fewer risks being taken at this year's edition of Freeze, and why do you think that was the case?
I mean, first of all, yeah, my editor, thanks to Krista Terry, wrote that amazing headline for the observer.com. But basically, you know, art fairs are corporate. It's so rare that we see something like Freeze, which has gone from having 200 galleries at their booths to like, you know, around 60. They've kind of shrunk it down. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but, you know, art fairs are a great place for a gallery to show off some of their best artists, some of their best work. And sometimes that's risky work that really makes a statement and stops people literally in their tracks. You're not just putting a JPEG on your Instagram account that people can scroll through or a video behind the scenes in an artist's studio. You're showing this in real life. So it better make an impact, better make a statement, because you're surrounded by competition everywhere. So, you know, risks, when I say that, it just kind of felt a little mediocre. It felt corporate and it felt like the galleries were just there to get some sales and get out. But I think that, you know, artists deserve a lot more credit than just that.
Yeah. And the fact that you noted this in your article was something that I really took notice of, because it does feel like when it comes to art criticism and even reporting around art fairs and other types of art-related events, we really don't see many strong opinions like this formulated. I guess it'd be great if you can share with us a little bit more about your journey as a journalist to arrive at this point in your career where you feel comfortable sharing these types of opinions that aren't expressed that often in the art media.
Yeah, I mean, I have to tell you, I've been writing about art for 15 years, and to be honest with you, it's probably the only thing that I can do right. I don't know what it is, but it's a gift. But I also went to art school in Toronto at Ontario College of Art and Design University, and I just, you know, saw like the game of, you know, MFA. And like, I was just like, you know, I'm probably not going to make a lot of money doing that. So I went to journalism school and they were teaching us to sort of be news robots and write about politics. That did not interest me. So, you know, I carved out, you know, a career myself writing about culture long before you could major in culture journalism, which is, I think, something you can do now at Columbia University and a few other places. I just figured it out. And, you know, I found mentors. I did my research and I just kind of wrote about what I loved. And, you know, it's funny because, you know, we look back on like October Magazine, we look back on Clement Greenberg, we look back on, you know, the greats, and it's like, we look up at Art Forum. Art Forum does not have the same power it used to have. You know, art reviews don't have the same power that they used to have. You know, reviewing art these days, it feels like is doing like a selfie from behind of you, looking at a work of art and just kind of posting it on Instagram and, you know, people taking that as like a form of visual philosophy. But, you know, it's taken me a long time to be able to freely express my opinion and for an editor to be okay with it and publishing my voice as it is. You know, I've written for the New York Times, I've written for the Guardian, I've written for so many places. And I don't know if it's just that I've been fearful to express my opinion and who I really am, or if I felt like I had to fit into some certain mold, or if it's just the publications going through certain editors, you know, certain sections, you can only say certain things. But for an art writer to be able to express their opinion freely, I feel like it's so rare and it's so valuable, because you're not being censored and you're not being edited. There's also consequence that comes with that. PR agencies that are hired by the art galleries, you know, can retort that and say, well, that's factually incorrect, we want that taken down, or it makes somebody look bad, so they figure out a reason to ask you to take it down or intimidate you because you're making far less money than they are. They can call you on the phone, you know, they can like talk you down, they can complain to your editor. There's a lot of ways that they figure out their way to regain that power. And it's scary and it's sad because, you know, art journalists have opinions too. We should be able to freely speak and not feel like we have to kiss the asses of the PR agencies and the galleries. I mean, I'm an art writer. I should be able to have an opinion whether you like it or not. And if I don't like the art that I see, I mean, I'd like to rather write about art that I do like, but it doesn't always have to be a puff piece, is what I'm saying.
I really appreciate you sharing all of that. And on a related note, lately, I've found myself having the same conversation with several people, reminiscing about a time really not that long ago, even perhaps 6, 7, 8 years ago, when most would eagerly await critics' reviews of exhibitions and really rely on critics' opinions to help formulate your own, maybe about the importance of an artist and to help digest their most recent body of work. But lately, it feels like that's changed drastically. Critics don't really have much influence, certainly not when it comes to the art market. And it seems like if a prominent art collector on Instagram posts an artist's work on their account, that would have a greater impact than even a positive review from a critic. And in general, nearly all content seems to be positive. We're in this social media phase of liking everything, only providing positive feedback, positive comments. A negative review is so rare to find, it's almost like a curiosity when you come across one.
Yeah, absolutely. I do fear that art criticism is dead. And, you know, most of our articles are just kind of screen grabbed with the headline and the byline and the first few sentences and posted on Instagram with a thanks so much for, you know, including me in your whatever. And people don't even read the article. But, you know, that's problematic because, I mean, critical thinking skills are developed through reading and a lot of people don't read anymore. But yeah, it's terrifying. And I do think that art criticism should still be alive, specifically outside of the academic institution. You know, you can have an MA, you can write about art critically, you know, within, you know, universities. I don't care. But like, you know, we need better art critics at all the newspapers, at all the magazines, who are unafraid, who are fearless, and who are willing to fuck shit up, you know. And like, I'm not saying going out there with guns blazing and like trying to attack people, but if something isn't good enough and it's presented in a solo show or an art fair and you want to question, I mean, come on, wake up. Why are you showing this when they have better work that you could be showing, or, you know, you have better artists, or, you know, you have to step up your game, not only as an artist, not only as a critic, not only as a writer, but as a curator, as a gallerist, you know, like all of these things matter. I mean, sometimes, you know, when you get a bad review, it's a wake-up call. It's not a bad thing. It just means you need to pull up your socks.
So getting back to the fair, you expressed that you felt galleries didn't take enough risks with the art they did exhibit at Frieze. But what were some of the aesthetic trends on view at the fair that you felt were in fact compelling?
Okay, I mean, like, I did see a lot of yarn art, which makes no sense because I don't really know why people would buy yarn-based, you know, wall works. A lot of knotted stuff. but yeah, it's, you know, trends, a lot of abstraction, obviously. Hassane Sahili like showed some amazing paintings. I really like the works that I saw at Italian galleries too. But visual trends, yeah, I like the glitter paintings of Chris Martin. I thought that it's fun when art is a party. You know, like back to the times of Mike Kelly, where it was a little messy and a little fun and very Sonic Youth. I mean, that era is kind of gone. The way that things are presented today are corporate, and it's just kind of like a to sell like a small dotted Kusama painting. But yeah, I mean, you know, I wanted to see more Maurizio Catalan, for example. But aesthetic trends, I mean, sculpture that was kind of, you know, iridescent, but sometimes boring. A lot of like paintings. I mean, Alex Katz had his own booth of like birch tree paintings, which is kind of like out of line for him when you think about it. But it was just, you know, it was like very comfortable, sort of above the couch, kind of buy this type of art.
And so for any of our listeners who actually haven't been to Frieze New York in the last few years, you may not realize that the venue actually shifted. It used to be at Randall's Island, in a traditional art fair kind of tent. And now it's at the Shed, which is a building in Hudson Yards. And it takes place over three floors. Each floor isn't the same size, and even the ceiling heights on the floors are different. That's just a long way of me saying that this isn't your typical art fair venue. And as a result, it seems that this polarizing venue is discussed much more frequently than any traditional art fair venue. What do you think is the consensus view in the art world about the Shed being the host of this art fair?
I mean, the Shed is, you know, it's strange because on the plus side, it's a respected institution that has had a ton of cash funneled into it. It's like a contemporary art center, but it's also a little bit of like a shopping mall format in the sense that it's three floors divided by escalators that you would see in a shopping mall and small doors that open up to these galleries. It's not built for an art fair. And it's also in a kind of an awkward neighborhood. Hudson Yards, as we know in the past, it used to be where all the subway cars used to be parked. And then those big developers came in and said, let's turn it into like a luxury paradise. And there's a huge shopping mall, a bunch of condos, you know, and this cultural institution called the Shed, trying to give it a little bit of cultural credibility. But does it really succeed? I don't know. It's north of Chelsea, but it's not really where you're going to find, you know, artists. It's not where you're going to find like a lot of creative people. It's a very like priced out area. But like I said, I mean, the Shed is not a place that you want to have an art fair. It looks cool, but it's just not built in the right way to cater to hundreds of people. When I went on the preview day on Wednesday, there was like a huge lineup. People were, you know, just out the door and then in the door. And then to, you know, each elevator, you had to sort of wait. And then not only that, but on the way out, you had to scan your virtual ticket on your phone just to get out. And that clogged up the line as well. So there was just a ton of lineups, a ton of crowds, and it was just a huge pain in the butt. I would have preferred if it was down the street at the Javits Center, you know, a convention center that's all flat. I mean, I know it's not as sexy and the fluorescent lighting maybe isn't as good, but a cubicle at an art fair is a cubicle at an art fair.
That's a good point. And so the Javits Center, which you did mention, is the home to the Armory Show, which occurs in September. And that, of course, is the other important fair in New York, along with Frieze New York. I think it's interesting that the two most relevant fairs in New York, they don't seem as important in the art fair circuit as many of the other fairs in different cities around the world. Do you agree with that assessment? And if so, why do you think that's the case?
I mean, you know, it's great that they still exist. I mean, the Armory Shore is kind of like it's a destination for a lot of people, and it kind of signals like the fall kickoff of, you know, culture in New York City. But at the same time, I don't really go because, I mean, I'm not there to buy art. Nobody's inviting me to give a talk. And, you know, art fairs are kind of dead. I feel like the collectors who want to buy stuff do so in advance and reserve things because they're having dinner parties with the gallerists anyways. And, you know, it's all very schmooze. I mean, I'm not sure that it's even worth, if you're a gallery and you're struggling, for you to pay anywhere between 20K and 100K just for that weekend, just to have a booth. I mean, isn't there a better way to reach the audience? I mean, look at JR. I mean, he just brings the art to the streets. I mean, that's a better way to reach the general audience if people are paying tickets to go in there. I mean, unless you're an art student, you think it's actually going to help your career to go in there and talk to people and think that they're going to pay attention to your art. I mean, I just don't know.
Well, there certainly has been a lot of discussions lately about the art fair model and just how reliant galleries should and have to be on it. And it does seem that with a somewhat softening art market, that galleries have recently started to become more selective when choosing which art fairs they will participate in and which ones they may be better off sitting out of.
Well, I just wish we had some more biennials. Like, I lived 9 years in Europe, okay? And I did a ton of cultural reporting there. I mean, I was based in Berlin, I was based in Paris, but going to Manifesta, which is like, even better than the Venice Biennale, was so, I mean, conceptual and pretentious, but also just kind of like, the Burning Man of conceptual art. Like, it was insane. And I think that there should be more things like that. The Whitney Biennial, I mean, yeah, but it's like run by a museum and it doesn't really have its own identity outside of that. But I just wish that we had more biennials in North America that, were worth, I mean, Manifest is every 5 years, but just something that wasn't attached to money. So I'm not saying I'm anti-capitalistic. I know these things need to be funded, but I just wish that there were more sort of offsite projects. So in that respect, I do like art fair that's called Spring Break, which happens, I believe, twice a year. And it's more indie and it's more focused on a collaboration between the artists and the curator who do their own booths in abandoned buildings that are going to be demolished or, renovated. So it's much more indie and much more, interesting for me, I feel like, as a viewer, because, I mean, yeah, and if you buy one of those works, which can be as cheap as $500, way more accessible, and you're going to change somebody's life. You're going to give them a lot of hope, and 50% of it probably will not go to some, corporate gallerist.
And so, as we touched on a little bit, there were a lot of art-related activities outside of Frieze Art Fair occurring in New York last week. We had several other art fairs. We had Future Fair, we had Nada, we had Esther, we had a lot of gallery openings, some very exciting ones. We had the auction previews. Were you able to get outside of Frieze New York? And if so, what were a few of your highlights of the week?
I mean, this is like totally unrelated, but the Met Museum, they just had their press conference this morning for their Costume Institute exhibition, which is, opening in partnership with the Met Gala, Sleeping Beauties. So, I mean, fashion exhibitions are their own thing, but, sometimes they turn out really well. And I do feel like this one is one of the better ones. So I would say that's a highlight, as well as, Spring Break. I mean, Future Fair, for sure. There's a lot of up and coming galleries there. If you want to see art that you probably have never seen before, beyond your typical corporate galleries that we just know all the names of, and it's just so predictable, that's the smaller galleries at the smaller fairs are really, worth checking out, because those people are going to talk to you. I mean, and that's kind of what you want. So yeah, there definitely were a lot of highlights, but I just encourage people, rather than going to things, I say, make your own noise, do your own party, do your own event. And I know that the Art Week does attract a lot of people who do come here, but don't be afraid to, jumpstart and do something for yourself, by yourself, to showcase your own work in whatever way you can in proximity to these things, just to get attention, because you don't always have to be represented by a gallerist.
Nadja, thanks so much again for coming onto the podcast. We really appreciated your recap of Frieze Art Fair, as well as your broader perspective on a variety of trends occurring in the art world. If our listeners haven't read your article in The Observer yet, recapping Frieze New York, I definitely recommend that they do. And where can we find you online to read your articles moving forward?
Yeah, you can check me out. Just Google me. I am Nadjasayej.
Perfect. Thanks again.